Good morning. Welcome to the panel discussion for this Friday, the 28th of October. Yes, 28th of October. Very nice to have you with us. And let us get into introducing the panelists, and then we'll get on with our conversation at large. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan.
Hi, everybody.
Author and activist Barbara Smith joins us. Good morning, Barbara.
Good morning.
And associate editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain, is here. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Very nice to have you all here. Let's go to a reminder as to how to be a part of the program. Roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear what you have to say on the issues that we talk about. We're going to start off with a I guess everything's political, isn't it? But a non-political story in the sense of we're not talking about the presidential campaign, and that is the Bundy brothers being acquitted in the takeover of the Oregon Wildlife Refuge. A bit of a surprise. Armed anti-government protesters led by Ammon and Ryan Bundy were acquitted Thursday of federal conspiracy and weapons charges stemming from the takeover of a federally owned wildlife sanctuary in Oregon last winter. The surprise acquittals of all seven defendants in federal district court was a blow to government prosecutors who had argued that the Bundys and five of their followers used force and threats of violence to occupy the reserve. But the jury appeared swayed by the defendants' contention that they were protesting government overreach and posed no threat to the public. Who wants to weigh in first?
It's mystifying.
Yes, it's shocking and mystifying. I can't put it any better way, you know. We weren't in the courtroom. We didn't hear, the presentation of the argument. And it was a jury trial, right?
Right.
I guess that goes to picking a jury is really important. And this happened in a rural part of Oregon, but the trial was in the biggest city in Oregon, Portland, and you think that a jury pool there would probably be not necessarily philosophically aligned with these protesters, but it is a very free-willing state, and maybe they couched it as free speech, a right to protest, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the federal government still has charges against them for their armed takeover and encampment, and I don't know how that will go, but it's very strange.
Well, when you describe what happened, it just seems unbelievable that anyone could hear the evidence and think that they hadn't done something that needed to be adjudicated in a negative, in a negative way.
Well, a negative way from the government's point of view.
Right.
But I think it just goes to show you whenever there's a six-week trial and we just hear about it at the end, We're obviously missing the tone of and the effectiveness of the defense attorney in presenting their case as making it, I guess, a free speech case, not a active armed aggression case, which still can be had against some of these folks. But, considering all the news coverage last year of this, it just seems impossible that they wouldn't be found guilty of some kind of crime.
Alan?
Well, that's the issue, of course. It's the conspiracy charge, which is the basis of all of this. You're right, Mike. There's going to be another trial. The judge clearly was not sympathetic to the attorney. The attorney yelled, "Free him now!" And the judge says, "Don't talk to me that way," basically. There was a little bit of chaos there. Look, let's not forget, at least one person died, if I'm not wrong, in all of this, was shot. And there is a presumption that something very wrong happened here. I was watching, I hate to say it, Morning Joe, who I really don't like that much, this morning. And he was furious about the rule of law, being upset. But I think it really came down to the concept of what constitutes a conspiracy.
I think you're right. It was probably decided on a very narrow issue. And, we weren't there to hear the judge charge the jury and describe what they were to decide on and what they were to not factor in. So let's see what happens with the government's case about the more aggressive you know, weapons takeover, the one that resulted in the shooting of their leader by a federal agent during a apparent escape attempt. But all of that, that still needs to play out, and this isn't over, I don't think.
Why do you think, Mike, and the whole panel, but just because you mentioned it, I thought it was interesting that this is a month-long trial, and we didn't hear anything about it. It wasn't being regularly covered. Do you think it was because it was just the assumption that they would be acquitted? Or, I mean, that they would not, you know, that they would be charged?
Well, from a news perspective, I'll bet you that it ranked low. I'm certain it must have been in the news in Oregon, but I don't know that. But I would assume it had day-to-day coverage in the local press. And this may not have been so surprising to the people who follow the case closely. But I think you're right. On a national news desk in October of 2016.
Other stuff going on?
There were a few other stories, weren't there?
A couple.
So it wasn't like the armed confrontation during a relatively slow news period. It was just a perfunctory, they're going to go to jail kind of prison, you know, go to prison after a trial kind of thing. And perhaps never gained the attention of the news directors who would make those decisions.
Well, now, do you think that it's a stretch to say that we have seen Bernie Sanders with his anti-establishment rhetoric? We have seen, Donald Trump try the same thing, that the government is oppressive and the rest of it. And one wonders, I mean, maybe a stretch, whether there may be a bit of a confluence for people who are really angry at the government.
I don't think that's new. If you look at
no, but I'm talking about this
jury.
Particular case and what's going on nationally, where people are really reacting to the so-called establishment.
Well, the term I think that gets used, although I didn't see it in this story by the New York Times, was jury nullification. It's when a jury is presented with more than overwhelming, compelling evidence of a crime, and overall they just reject the whole notion and come back with a not guilty verdict. And it seems like this, although I don't want to make that, because, I hadn't been following this case. I was not even that aware that it was going on because of other things that were in the news, you know?
Well, maybe it's just an attempt to stick it to the man.
Yeah. No, I hear what you're saying. I mean, Barbara, you're right. It's a prevalent belief by a segment of society that you're not going to get a fair shake. And maybe it was elevated by the Bernie Sanders campaign and perhaps to another population, the Donald Trump campaign. And, you know, Donald Trump's constantly asserting that the system is rigged, I think that hits home to people who've been not done well with the system, whatever the system is, and they'd like to stick it to the man, whoever that man is. And in this particular case, maybe that played into it, you know, that attitude that, you know, it's stacked against us, the government, the whole system is stacked against the little guy, and in some small way, maybe it played into the jury's belief that the defense presented, that they were just protesting what they thought was an unjust government policy. Not that they had taken over government facilities and refused to leave with lots of guns and bulldozers and all kinds of things, and that they desecrated sacred Indian Native American burial grounds and all that. I mean, that didn't come up, but I'm sure it'll come up in the next trial.
Let's take a break when we come back.
Go.
Let's take a break when we come back. We'll continue with our conversation. We have other issues to discuss. Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Barbara Smith. We'll be right back.
Support for WMC comes from Utica College, working to help solve the college affordability issue with its tuition reset initiative, utica.edu/affordable. the Arthur Zankel Music Center at Skidmore College, a cultural resource for the upstate region, providing a teaching, recording, and performance venue with rental options available, skidmore.edu/ZANKEL. Sage Wine and Spirits, Boston Spa, New York, providing worldwide sustainable and organic wines and spirits, offering weekly tastings, sagewinespirits.com. And Albany Institute of History and Art in downtown Albany, featuring galleries, shop, and cafe, presenting The Art of Seating, 200 Years of American Design through December 31st, albanyinstitute.org.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. The 25th anniversary of Justice Clarence Thomas's confirmation to the Supreme Court has featured testimonials from his supporters, a symposium on his jurisprudence, and tributes from conservative legal scholars about his influence on the court. But Thursday brought an unwelcome echo of the sexual harassment allegations that almost derailed his 1991 nomination. An Alaska lawyer told the National Law Journal that Thomas groped her at a dinner party in 1999 when he was a young Truman Foundation scholar in Washington. Through a court spokeswoman, Thomas told the publication this claim is preposterous and it never happened. The woman, Moira Smith, said she decided to make the allegations not because of Thomas, but because of Donald Trump. She posted the information on her Facebook page on October 7th, hours after the media disclosed that Trump had boasted on tape about grabbing women. Barbara?
Sounded quite credible. What is in it for her to be bringing something up like this at this time? The context in which it happened, the fact that these were, you can't be a Truman scholar. That's a high honor, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just anyone who could even be awarded that and be in that context. I think that the horrible Access Hollywood tape has really unleashed and uncovered and made it more possible for all women to speak out about things that they've experienced. And there's just so much irony, and that's to put it nicely and mildly, there's so much irony that these high-ranking males seem like they can get away with so much stuff. The more women who speak out, the more we begin to understand what sexual harassment, sexual assault, misogyny, what all those things are. And then I would hope we as a society would try to address that and change that.
It's interesting because the original, Clarence Thomas confirmation hearing, it really back, I guess, in 94 or around then.
It was a little bit earlier than that, I think.
91. Mm-hmm. Back then, it did kick off a awareness of what sexual harassment was, sexual harassment in the workplace, et cetera, and it put it on the front burner. I think it had momentum. I think the contribution of Anita Hill bringing it up, although she didn't prevent Thomas from being confirmed and people didn't believe her. I think since then, there's probably a lot of people who are saying, maybe she had a point there. But between, the 25 years and then fast forward to Bill Cosby, evidently he had been from every, news report in the last couple of years, he had been a sexual predator. And it started to come out. When it came out more and more, more women felt comfortable talking about it and felt it was important to go public. And, we know how that turned out. And then with Donald Trump, after the tape came out, it spurred more people to say it's okay to talk about it. I didn't do anything wrong if I was victimized by a abusive male or an abusive person in any case, and it's helpful for me to come out and speak out about it. And that's a very courageous thing for a victim of a crime to do. And when it's a sexual crime, I think it must
even
be much
so.
More difficult.
And
But as more people do it, though, and in this particular case, this attorney, this woman who was a young Truman Foundation scholar back in 1999, felt that the women coming forward after the Donald Trump tape came out emboldened her to step forward and get something out that had been bothering her for a long time. And it isn't like she held a press conference either. She put it on her Facebook page, which I guess in 2016 is almost like that.
While you were still talking, the fact that she told other people at the time.
Right.
That's I think, very, convincing and very indicative of, like, did it actually happen?
Yeah, the Washington Post found people who said, yes, she did tell us about that. And that does add to credibility. And you could certainly see why a young attorney in Washington, D.C. would be terrified at the notion of accusing a sitting Supreme Court justice of acting, committing acts of sexual harassment. What that could do to a career.
Yeah, I assume she was a law student at that time.
Yeah, probably,
Alan?
Well, the only thing I can say is what Mike and Barbara said. What they said is right. I mean, I'm always willing to say we live in a society where people can make unjust claims. But on the other hand, I think in this case, all the things that Mike and Barbara have said about other people having been told about it at the time, the stature of the student in this case, and the Anita Hill thing, which all goes to sort of come to a central point here.
When you look at where we go from here with an allegation like this, does it just stay? Is it just that she has told her story and is that the end of it, or do you think it'll go further?
Well, one of two things. My opinion is, certainly it may embolden other women who may or may not, if there were any other women who may have been sexually harassed by Clarence Thomas, it may embolden them to step forward and I'd be nervous if there were other cases if I was Clarence Thomas. It has hurt his reputation already. If it's an untrue assertion, it has really unfairly hurt his reputation. It's really beyond what would be the statute of limitations. It's very difficult to prove these things in a court of law when they're that old.
Right.
And that's why the courts don't take cases like this ordinarily. She hasn't said she was going to sue him or anything like that. I think that the other impact of this, on top of the Donald Trump...
I'm going to have to pause
there. Yeah.
We're going to pause you there. We're going to take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk about some of the other impacts of the story. Okay. And we'll get your letters as well. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. It's the 28th of October. Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, and Barbara Smith make up the group. And we welcome your letters, roundtable at WAMC.org. Just before we went to break, I cut off Mike in mid-sentence, who was talking about two of the things that may come out of this. And you were just getting to your second point that one of the things is that that people may learn a lesson and not do this kind of thing.
Right. I think the goal of sexual harassment sensitivity training, like in the workplace or generally, is to enlighten people about how a woman might feel if you whistle at her or you make a gesture or you say something or you touch her in an what we know is now an unfriendly or unacceptable way. I think there generally were men who did not realize the impact of that, made aware of how it made a person feel or how it made other people feel who witnessed that. They're enlightened and they change their behavior. Then there's the other part of it. When you go through this kind of program, you learn that if you get caught doing this, you're fired. You lose your job. You can be sued. And there's no tolerance. So even if you don't accept that your behavior is abhorrent, you know the consequences of it, and if you do it, you face the consequences. So and that all happened, I think, in the 90s. I attribute a lot of it to Anita Hill stepping forward courageously, and you know, and I think that her reputation has survived. I think she's regarded as a brilliant and professor and academic, and her career probably has been affected by it, but. She stands tall today. That's my opinion.
I think people have a lot of admiration for her. I did want to point out that the issue of sexual harassment had been worked on probably starting in the late 70s into the early 80s. There was a landmark case at Yale University. Catherine McKinnon was the attorney for that student. And that was when sexual harassment as a recognized form of sexual
discrimination,
yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Was brought up.
Civil rights violation.
Yeah. It didn't have the visibility, but it was the beginning of building the legal understandings and the social outrage about it. So, by the time the Anita Hill case came along, that other case that I was speaking about had already happened, and people were looking at it certainly in the women's movement all over the country.
Let's go to some letters, Alan. We got this on Bundy, okay. And not only that, but on this story as well.
Joe, I need some instruction here, which is we're getting a lot of mail, but it's not always on the subject we're talking about. Would you like me to keep it just to that, or shall we just
I think we have letters on Bundy and and that case, and we have letters on the this story about Clarence Thomas.
Okay, and we have one from. D in Longmeadow, who says, any comments by the panel on Sean Hannity's offer to pay for one-way tickets to Kenya for the Obama family when they leave the White House in January? Now, my reaction to that one is, when you are a talk show host and you're competing with a bunch of other foul-mouthed talk show hosts, you need to throw more and more red meat to the people who are likely to listen to you and to tune in to you. And it seems to me this is just more of the same from Hannity, who's just an awful person.
So my question is, anyway, why would it be of so much concern to him that they continue to reside in the country of their respective births as U.S. citizens following the presidency? He will no longer be president. She will no longer be first lady, and the children will no longer be the first children. So what's your problem with having highly talented, contributing black people live in the country with you? What's the deal?
I'm sure you heard what I said, Barbara, which is that it has nothing to do with anything that's logical or not logical.
Right. Well, I just want to point out who he wants to get out of this country. The kinds of people
I get it.
He wants to get out of
this
country.
I'll
look for my ticket then too.
And well, it's just offensive rhetoric. It's what they, you know, it's their stock and trade. And I think you're exactly right. He's competing with other vicious right wing talk show hosts, and he has to do something to satisfy his base.
I find it fascinating that if he says it on television, it becomes news. Meanwhile, all of these hosts say things that are 10 times worse than this and more repulsive on radio every day, and
point.
It just sort of goes by the wayside.
Good point.
But it is, which it shouldn't, so I'm glad this was reported, but still, it's...
Well, I mean, civility is one of the topics that...
Not their middle name.
...comes up, right, comes up because of this election, and it has brought to the front burner, like, the behavior, the comments, the gestures, the signs at Trump rallies have you know, opened people's eyes to, you know, this new level of saying outrageous things and getting away with it, I guess. And we tolerate it in a free society, but it's a difficult area to navigate.
Carol, Nurse Carol, our Nurse Carol, says, what's the panel agree that Bill Clinton conduct with Monica Lewinsky in the Oval Office would have led to his firing had he been the CEO of any major corporation. I read the wrong letter. That's from Roger. And Roger said, does the panel agree that Bill Clinton's conduct with Monica Lewinsky in the Oval Office would have led to his firing had he been the CEO of any major corporation? The answer to that question, folks?
Well, I mean, I've never worked in the corporate sectors, so I can't really say exactly how things go there, but it would seem to me that that might be a likely outcome.
Yeah, in the mid-90s, perhaps less than today, but it has frequently been the cause of removal of people from very high-level positions, both in academia and in the corporate world. And in politics, when you're elected and you're the president, and it gets complicated.
I think, wasn't the impeachment about him having lied?
It was that he had lied, but it was related to this. You know, related to his behavior.
No, I know it was related to the behavior, but I thought that the impeachment charges were around him having not told the truth about the behavior.
They were. But we would have to be horribly, in response to the question, we'd have to be horribly naive not to think it goes on all the time. And that a lot of these guys survive.
Right. But that was 20 years ago almost. And it has changed. And I think it is under more pressure right now for people to behave. And I'm not saying it doesn't happen. I'm not saying it doesn't happen with frequency. But I'll bet it happens a lot less. And I'll bet more people are being prosecuted for it. Or not prosecuted so much, but are facing consequences. Negative consequences.
I'm sure you're right. Nurse Carol, I want to get to her letter because I falsely said I was reading it. Hi, roundtable panelists. The acts themselves are disturbing enough. What is additionally distressing to me that these acts are so devastating to women, so disturbing that it can affect them for the rest of their lives, is so inconsequential to men that they go about the rest of their lives totally discounting what they've done. Dare I suggest put their actions so completely out of their minds that they, in essence, sanitize their own histories, hereby being able to stand up in public with the horrified expressions on their faces to declare, that never happened, she's a liar, etc. You folks are great, thank you. And that's from Carol. Okay, and then another letter on a different subject from James, who says, what is your reaction to the story of Joe Biden being Secretary of State? If it is true, and VP Tom Kaine will counter Hillary's personal negatives, I love the idea of having Joe around in such a prominent position for the next 4 years, and he would make an excellent Secretary of State, and that's from Jim. What do you guys think? Do you think that he would take that after being Vice President?
Well, he was Chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. He certainly is capable.
No, he has the expertise.
Yeah.
No, he has the expertise.
Do you remember when Jill Biden said when Obama came in that he was offered either the vice presidency or the secretary of state and then kind of walked it back right away?
Yeah.
It was kind of an awkward moment there for John Kerry.
Well, if you were him, would you do it?
Well, I just keep thinking about the tragedy that the family has recently suffered and also his age. Yeah. I heard it this morning too, and it made me wonder about how much more of this madness does he want to be involved in. But he seems to
love it.
He seems to love to be.
I have to check it. I think he's 74.
Joe Biden.
And also he is. I mean, I've been seeing in the West. He was just in Burlington recently in our region, working on cancer, and that's become his mission. Obviously, after the loss of his son. And there had been some talk, I know, in interviews he has said that is going to be his focus, that he wants to work on that and stay focused on that. And if you get 2 years and you can do this job, I don't know. He does seem to enjoy it, to be in that spotlight.
Well, he certainly is a very popular public figure. And who's had a great career. But I agree with you, Joe. I mean, I think he has said, I mean, he wants that, you know, moon landing type approach to finding a cure for cancer and dedicate that to his son, Beau, and everybody else who's, suffered from cancer. And he, that seems to be already in the works, so I'd be surprised. Yet, I think if the president of the United States asked him to do it, he probably would, because he's a very dedicated American.
He'll be 74 at the end of the administration.
I see.
I think he turns on the 13th.
A young man.
Yes.
A young man. So Robert writes an interesting letter. Bob, panel, please discuss the Times article on Trump supporters anticipating an armed response to a Hillary victory. Do you think that will happen, or at least on a small scale? Now, I've said in the past, and I seldom watch him, but I watched him this morning, Morning Joe, Joe Scarborough, and I have to tell you, I was infuriated with the guy because basically he blamed the Times for giving much space to what might happen based on what a few people, a few followers have said. And when one of his panel members had the temerity to take him on about it, he shut him up. He wouldn't let him talk. It was not good. And there are those, and I want to remind everybody, all it takes is one. That's all it takes. One guy with a gun.
Well, as I said, I believe it was just last week, what concerns me are the miscellaneous hate crimes that may very well roll out right after this election, if it doesn't go the way that Trump supporters wish it to. There were hate crimes that happened after and on the day that President Obama was elected in 2008, and I didn't have time. I meant to do this. Maybe one of the two of you could, or three of you could do that. I'm wondering, were there hate crimes also that happened after the election of 2012, right after the election of 2012? Because that really concerns me. And that's so much less predictable and less trackable than what these people are talking about, going out with guns and doing whatever. I think all of this talk is very, very upsetting.
Well, the Trump candidacy has emboldened people to say outrageous things. As we talked before, civility seems to have been put on the shelf. People say extremely grotesque, offensive things about Hillary Clinton on their T-shirts when they come to the rallies. They hold up signs. They yell out obscenities regarding mm-hmm. Hillary. And I guess it's acceptable to that group. So they might say outrageous things like, you know, if she wins, we're just going to, you know, get the militia and take over.
Were you asking about 2008?
No, I had last week I had looked up, I put in hate crimes 2008 following president, you know, following election.
Right.
I didn't put
which
in,
actually went down.
Okay, in 2012.
2%.
Uh-huh.
But then in 2012, the next election cycle?
That's what I was wondering, right around the election in 2012, were there also some hate crimes that occurred? Because, as I said, there was a church that was burned to the ground in Springfield, Massachusetts, right, you know, in our neighborhood, so to speak. Right. There were at least two individuals who were murdered. And the crimes, are the way that the people who perpetrated them justified them or described them, was in response to Obama's success.
Alan?
Yeah. Well, again, I want to come back to loudmouth, foulmouth, guys on the radio who talk to people, and there will always be some who believe what they're hearing. And that's where our real problems come, because now you don't have gun control. You have guns in the hands of people who really shouldn't have them, we all know that, and who, on listening to one of these people, will take a gun and say, you know, I'm perfectly justified in doing this. That is what is so troubling to me. I agree with you, Barbara, but I'm telling you, on a case-by-case basis, this can be very scary.
The question is, was the Times story responsible, quoting these Trump activists as saying, if push comes to shove, Mrs. Clinton has to go by any means necessary and it will be done. You know, I mean, to say.
Well, what do you think? You're the journalist. You're the editor.
Yeah. If somebody who is a leader of a movement or has a position in the campaign, but just to go around like the Times did, they interviewed like 50 people at Trump rallies around the country and they got these comments, and people say really stupid things when they're at political rallies. They go all fired up. But if the leadership of Trump's campaign was saying that, I think it would have a different stance. I think they're looking for ways to channel this anger after the election, perhaps, as we've mentioned before, into a television network or some movement or something.
And given the ethos of our country, they may very well channel it into individual acts of violence against those they consider to be.
Well, that's the risk, some whack job someplace is going to read and do it.
And yet somebody like Morning Joe, obviously, is trying to, I mean, he didn't use these words, or I didn't hear them anyway, suggest that the Times is so in the corner of Hillary. that they're willing to fan the flames.
All
That's
right.
the ethics journalism question.
Let's take a break.
Leonard. Oh,
well,
sure.
Yeah, let's take a break. We'll come back and get to Leonard's letter and much more after this.
Support for WMC comes from the Honest Weight Food Co-op, 100 Watervliet Avenue, Albany, New York, specializing in local and organic produce, natural groceries, fine cheeses, locally raised meats, and ready-to-go organic meals, honestweight.coop. Amherst Copy and Design Works, offering printing and copying, sign making and design services, from booklets to stationery and labels to lawn signs, in downtown Amherst, Massachusetts, amherstcopy.com. Mizzentop Day School, Pauling, a co-ed pre-K through 8th grade independent school with small classes and an emphasis on values, academics, and community. Explore, experience, discover, mizzentop.org. And Steve Lewis Subaru, Hadley, Massachusetts, a new and used Subaru dealer serving the Pioneer Valley, Hartford, and Springfield, offering new Subarus plus used cars, trucks, and SUVs. SteveLewisSubaru.com.
As promised, we have a letter from Leonard.
Okay, yes, that's correct. Leonard says, hello, panel. Can you please comment on the Standing Rock protest? Let me just start it off by saying I was talking to a brilliant academic just this morning who said to me, this is just another in the long history of the American people's or the country screwing the Indians in this country, the Native Americans in this country. And, one more time, we give them worthless land, and then when somebody wants to put something through it, I'm quoting my friend, when they want to put something through it, everybody stands up and says, aren't they terrible not letting them do that? And on their ancestral grounds and everything else. That's my two cents.
And this is in the case of the Dakota Access Pipeline, where more than 100
yes.
were arrested yesterday as protesters
yep.
were ousted from the camp. Authorities used pepper spray and fired beanbags at activists demonstrating against the North Dakota oil pipeline as the standoff there reached a new peak and continues as we speak. Other letters?
Oh, yeah, there are many. Polly, our Polly from, as you know, Joe, our program on copyright. Polly says, au contraire, the Bundy trial was covered in the New York Times on an ongoing basis. True, it wasn't often on the front page, but it was constantly reported on, says Polly. That's, I think what she's saying, our bad that we didn't get to the inside of the newspaper. There were lots and lots of letters on Bundy that have come in. I don't know what else to tell you other than the Bundy case, purely white privilege. Can you imagine if it had been black or brown men with guns? Interesting.
Totally different outcome we could anticipate.
You wonder if
Bill
they'd be around for a trial.
That's a question, too. Because if unarmed black men and women, but mostly men, are being shot, then a lot of black and brown people in one place, all with guns. Yeah, that doesn't sound like it would have turned out the same way.
Bill says it would seem that the defense had a better lawyer. That's what Bill says. And Carolyn says the BBC coverage seems to focus on charges of a conspiracy to, in capital letters, harm government employees working on the preserves. And that is from actually Sadie in Skodak. All right. And Peter says, Justice Thomas, her claim, like most of the Trump accusers, gains credibility by contemporaneous accounts from friends and relations. It does not seem logical that someone would make up a story, tell others the story, in the expectation that years later it could be used, and that's from Peter. And Dan says, oh yeah, Dan, that's something else. And Sean says, the hypocrisy lies in the fact that NPR did their best to defend Bill Clinton, as did Hillary, of all of his sexual predilections and abuses of women. Anybody on that one?
NPR did?
I didn't realize NPR involved in a conspiracy there.
Well, no, I think that's the allegation that liberal NPR was far too
sure.
Nice.
No, but
to
we're trying to figure out how and when that happened.
I was saying that cynically. I think the coverage this time around and the coverage of Donald Trump's the reports about his own behavior have put new light on Bill Clinton's past behavior, and I don't think he's coming out so favorably as he might have emerged in the end of the 90s. You know, there's new awareness.
Okay. Nick says, good morning, Roundtable. Good morning. With all those allegations, all these allegations of sexual harassment cases coming forward, it has become increasingly disturbing to hear. This makes you almost ashamed to be a man in today's world. And that's from Nick.
One feels shame or embarrassment, then the way to counter that and really kind of heal your spirit and soul is that you talk to other people who may have similar feelings, who want to do something about it, and begin to speak out. Speaking out and flipping the script when people are going down a really oppressive and disrespectful path can help to change embarrassment and shame to, at least I'm kind of on an even keel now because I'm countering all that badness.
That's true, yeah.
Michael says, Clarence, Thomas had a long list of favorite porno tapes at his local video store that everyone knew about, but for some reason I've never understood, was not allowed to be presented at his confirmation hearing. Anyone?
Oh, there's the First Amendment. I mean,
yeah, that was, we got into the whole thing at that time of what he had taken out on his library card and what he had taken out at his video store. And then the larger question of, does taking out pornography from your local video store immediately make you a sexual predator?
Yeah, I think that's a leap.
And how many copies of Penthouse is sold in this country was at the time? You know, every month or week, whatever they do, you know, an awful lot of people. And the number one thing on cable for years, the only thing that made money was porno. There you go.
That's right.
Okay.
Being involved in porno or pornography, but I don't know that that's a sign of illness or pathology.
Well, it's not the same. It isn't the same as active sexual harassment of you know, people or of women. You know, maybe you don't appreciate that, but it's legal in that country.
All right, we're going to take a break here and go to the news. We'll be back in just a moment, and stay tuned. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion for this morning, this Friday morning. And Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, and Barbara Smith make up our panel this morning. We welcome your letters at roundtable@wamc.org. I would like to begin this section with a story that Mike's paper has been working on and following and is a fascinating case.
Yeah, it's our story today by Robert Gavin about a controversial case involving an Albany teenager, Marquis Dixon, who was found guilty in 2014 of an armed robbery over a pair of sneakers. An Albany judge, a state Supreme Court judge in Albany at the time, sentenced Dixon to 9 years in state prison, even though he was 16 and would ordinarily have been eligible for what we call youthful offender status, a different handling of the case. He was sent off to an adult prison. The Green Correctional Facility is where he is right now. There were a lot of cries that it was unjust, and there was a lot of protests about it. Our own Chris Churchill, a regular on the Roundtable, wrote quite a few columns about it and certainly drew a lot of attention to it, and he should get a lot of credit for that. And eventually, the case was appealed, and back in September, the Appellate Division of State Supreme Court here, the panel of judges in Albany, heard the case. And even during that proceeding. The presiding judge, Karen Peters, seemed to indicate that an error had taken place. And yesterday they handed down the ruling. It was a unanimous ruling by the judges that it was incorrect not to have given youthful offender status to Marquis Dixon. They imposed a new sentence of 1 to 3 years. And that means he should be out of jail perhaps right now. You know, he might be. Have you heard anything, Barb?
No, I haven't. Yeah. But I'm on a listserv that I would. And
okay.
That's the Capital Area Against Mass Incarceration group, which was very involved in bringing this case to public attention and protesting the verdict. And it's really exciting that efforts for justice, for once, turned out this way. The fact that he was not given youthful offender status back in September when it was before the appellate court, that judge right out of the box.
Right,
said
Judge Peters
that,
said right
yeah,
there,
that,
like,
that
there's
not,
been a mistake since the beginning of this case,
right,
she said.
Right, yeah. And it brings up also the issue of raise the age. As I said, it's
New York is like one of two states in the country that won't raise the age to 19 and even farther. A lot of other states are a lot more progressive in how they deal with crimes by teenagers, essentially. But under the New York's youthful offender law, you'll spend no more than 4 years in jail. You sort of and your case gets sealed. In fact, in the court ruling yesterday, they didn't use his last name. You know?
I know.
they are honoring. I mean, it's out. But,
yes.
But they're honoring
yes.
The intent of the youthful offender law, which if you go to apply for a job, if Marquis Dixon should go apply for a job, he's 19 now. Maybe next year he'd go apply for a job, or when he gets out of jail, he does not have to check the box that said, "Have you ever been convicted of a crime?" Because under law, he hasn't been. The record has been sealed. Now, that's not to say that it wasn't a very serious case. And Judge Peters and the appellate court did say that there was a serious crime committed. He's accused of using Facebook to make an appointment to buy a pair of sneakers from another teenager and met him. And the issue that was under contention was whether he pulled a gun out. The other guy said,
"Or showed him a gun." I don't
or showed
know.
Him a gun. Yeah. Not even pulled
yeah,
it out.
He supposedly,
you know, opened his jacket.
Allegedly,
and he had a gun.
Yeah. He lifted his shirt.
He cooperated with authorities.
So Barbara, why do you show somebody a gun as opposed to?
Well, under contention, Alan. It wasn't even
the question.
Proven.
Was it a gun?
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
one of the questions.
Yeah, that was in dispute. He cooperated with authorities and said he never had a gun. The other guy said he thought he saw a gun.
I see.
And that became it. But if under law, if you display a gun, even if you don't hold it and aim it at somebody, like you go into a bank and you say, "Give me all your money," and you open your jacket and you've got a gun there, that is equivalent to pulling a gun. That's an armed robbery. So, but was it what was that dispute? Was it was you know word against word, where Dixon, who cooperated with authorities, still a crime. It's still a felony, ordinarily, but somebody in that situation would ordinarily be eligible for youthful offender status and wasn't given it. Now, the appellate court did not send it back to the local judge,
right.
the state Supreme Court judge, Breslin, who sentenced Dixon to 9 years. It just reimposed it, ended the case. He'll probably be without, out of prison. He could be there a few more weeks. He could be out this weekend, you know, depending on how they handle it.
I don't think apparently Judge Peters and that court didn't want it to be overturned. I mean,
they just ended it. They
yeah,
just said
yeah,
reimposed
the
sentence and that's it. Now, I don't know if David Soares, the district attorney in Albany County, could decide to take it to the state's top court, the Court of Appeals. That's I'd be surprised if that happens, but I guess that's an option.
Right, yeah. Indeed. This whole situation, though, of like not viewing and it's not even about viewing, not assessing and treating these young people who commit crimes or who are accused of committing crimes at such a young age, it's a real problem. And I think this case, you know, is taking us and the way this case has been resolved takes us in the direction that we need to go in relationship to that. There's another young man who was tried as an adult for something he did when he was 17. His name was Benjamin Van Zandt, and he also was not granted that youth offender status, nor did it seem to be taken into account that he was living with mental illness. He committed suicide. And full disclosure, I've been at a presentation where his parents talked about what happened. They tried everything. They tried everything to get him into a safer situation and as he was incarcerated. But at the end of the day, he was afraid of being beaten up or killed by someone else. So he killed himself.
Tragedy.
All right. One other thing, we have a few minutes, and one other topic I want to talk about, and that is early voting. I know this is going on in Massachusetts. I know, Alan, you've already voted.
I have. Rosella's voted. Yeah, you go in there. Yep.
Millions of people have voted, and Democrats are showing strong signs in key states. This, according to the Los Angeles Times, the millions of votes already cast in the presidential election show promising signs for Hillary Clinton, with Democrats registering a strong performance in key states such as Florida and Colorado. So there's that case. But do you think that there is also a case to be made that maybe other states are looking at this and saying, oh, you know, maybe this is a good idea?
Well, I think it's a good idea, and I wonder why New York State doesn't do it. You have to be infirmed or traveling out of the area in order to qualify for an absentee ballot in New York. I just got back from a trip to North Carolina, where I went with my 87-year-old mother-in-law to Town Hall, and there was a line around the building. It was like an hour wait to go in for early voting. So people really do it. And she couldn't wait. It was difficult for her to stand in the sun for that long. So my wife picked her up, and we were driving out of the lot, and there was a sign that said curbside voting. And we pulled over.
I like that.
A volunteer came out with a clipboard, got her information, went in, brought her out a ballot, and she voted.
So,
you know, why not make it easy for people to vote?
Well, that's exactly the right question, Mike. The answer is that we know how it works. Every time we try to extend the franchise, basically the Republican Party says no. Now, I'm not going to hold them totally innocent, the Democrats totally innocent. I'll tell you why. Because people, even in the assembly in New York and Democratic congressmen, they got there the old way. And they are not about to risk making it a new way. So when you ask why other states don't do it, that's the reason why. They're controlled by Republican legislatures, or we have a New York State Senate, which isn't going to do it. There's a reason for it, and that is they are threatened by it. And as again, they use the laws for their own protection.
Now, how many people voted nationally so far, Joe? Like 15 million
people?
Yeah,
something like that. Yes.
Huge number.
So they don't think they can be elected if the maximum number of people vote. I know that it's a common understanding that large turnout, high turnout favors Democrats and low turnout favors Republicans. I know that's common, you know, as I said, understanding.
Yeah.
But it just, I mean, as somebody who ran for office myself, you know, like I wanted everybody who could to vote. But of course, it's in Democratic Albany County, so we're not talking about...
Excuse me, but weren't you a Democrat running in the city of Albany, Barbara?
I was running in a Democratic primary, yes.
But the thought was there. That's what counts. All right, we have about 3 minutes, so let's fill out our time with some letters, and then we'll be ready to go.
Well, Flit wrote, and I can't find the letter in front of me right here, but I can tell you what she said. It was very interesting. She said that she worked in a school, and there were two men who worked there, and they were constantly being harassed by the women, or some of the women, who worked there. Just to make the point, she said, it isn't only women who are on the receiving end of that.
Well, and harassment is harassment.
Yes, and we know that to be true, and it's all wrong. All of it's wrong.
Dave says, youthful offender. The problem with youthful offender status is that these 16 and 17-year-olds are still sent to adult state prison. New York needs to truly raise the age of criminal responsibility and send these cases to family court. Although the governor has been supportive of raising the age, his proposal does not include robbery and burglary in the list of crimes that would send the youth to family court. Instead of adult criminal court, these are two of the highest voluming crimes for 16 and 17-year-olds and must be included in any raise of the age legislation. I don't want to be seen as a right winger here, but you know, if you've got a kid and somebody else comes along and they're underage and they put a bullet through your kid and kill them, you're not going to exactly want youthful offender status.
No, it's tricky, and there are options to
Hello, are you there?
No.
I think we're thinking.
It's tricky. prosecutors have the opportunity to try certain crimes and teenagers as adults.
Yes.
And that's what happened in this case of Marquis Dixon, and the appellate court said it was inappropriate to do that.
But usually when that happens, there is violence, there's bodily harm, there is death. So
yep.
I think that we would hope that there would be discretion, legal discretion used around crimes that rose to a much higher level of harm than stealing a pair of sneakers.
Right.
Yeah. Steven says, "Hi, folks. As far as I understand it, the absentee ballots in New York are not counted until after the election." I think that's true. It's true in Massachusetts. I was told that by the deputy town clerk, who said, because I had come in and wanted an absentee ballot, and she said, "Well, you know, if you vote, and it hadn't started yet, if you wait a couple of days and you vote, you will hear, your vote will be counted along with everybody else's. Whereas if you do it absentee." Basically, it's my understanding anyway that the time that they really count the absentee ballots are when you got a close election.
Right. So, if you won by 5,000 votes and there were 200 absentee ballots filed, they're not going to waste their time adding up those votes. That's right.
We are out of time. I want to thank everybody for being with us this morning. Alan and Mike and Barbara, thank you so much. We'll be back on Monday with another panel. Have a great weekend. We'll be back with more show, including Gary Trudeau, next on the Roundtable.